because this might be the inner chronicle of what we are, and we have to articulate ourselves, otherwise we would be cows in the field.
Welcome to Cows in the Field, a movie podcast that tries to channel the spirit of Werner Herzog. My name is Justin.
I'm Laura.
And today we have a very special episode. We're talking about the 1998 film, The Last Days of Disco, and we're honored to be joined by the film's writer, director, and producer, Whit Stillman.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
There's something deeply ingrained in human biology. Women prefer bad over weak and indecisive and unemployed.
I don't know about that.
You think they do prefer weak, indecisive, and unemployed?
What if in a few years we don't marry some corporate lawyer? What if we marry some meatball like you?
The Last Days of Disco follows the stories of several recent graduates from elite colleges as they navigate the rocky transition into adulthood. Disco dancers by night and editorial assistants at a publishing house by day, Alice, played by Chloe Sevigny, and Charlotte, played by Kate Beckinsale, negotiate relationships punctuated by a rotating cadre of Harvard men. It's a wry depiction of UBS, the urban haute bourgeoisie, played with such a light touch that one can't help but fall in love with these characters, even in their worst moments. And it's also semi-autobiographical, which is where we want to start today. So, as this is a film, third film of a trilogy, with Metropolitan and Barcelona being the first and second respectively, that's loosely based on your own life experiences, we wanted to start off with the following question. So we're curious, where is Whit Stillman in this colorful cast of characters? And if it isn't one character, are you maybe a composite, such as like they do in New York Magazine?
Yeah, I think you have to do that when you're writing. You have to divide up your particular interests and points of view in different characters. I think Metropolitan was the most closely related to actual people and situations, and Barcelona then somewhat less, but still. And I'd say Disco less than those two films. Mm. So I'm not sure how much it's really autobiographical, except that I tried to put in some milieu that I knew, like book publishing. And so the book publishing company is very similar to Doubleday, which had a training program that I went into. But there's nothing particularly individual, personal about the characters.
That's so fascinating because it's so specific. Like the characters just really feel like they were ripped from some real experience. And part of the reason I mentioned this is that I when I first saw The Last Days of Disco, the thing that resonated with me was how it felt like it captured my experience at graduate school. So for me, graduate school was my post-collegiate experience. So it was the time when I was having the kinds of conversations the people in The Last Days of Disco are having, like this kind of, you know, intellectual conversations, but we're also, there's a kind of naivete about them. Everyone's trying out ideas. And it really did remind me of what it was like just being at Yale and sitting around the dining hall and having those kinds of chats, which is why I felt like, oh my gosh, maybe Whit was drawing from experience here. But if not, I wonder if would you say these characters in a way represent different parts of yourself? Like you're almost having a conversation with yourself with using them?
Well, I don't know. I mean, yes, there's a lot of sort of personal knowledge of things and people I'm close to, and there's a lot of that, but I couldn't really parse it out with that film. While with Metropolitan I really could. And I think one of the things that made Metropolitan a really happy experience is that it was based in some really funny people, and they're still funny if they're still alive, and they keep on being funny in those ways, strong. So in Metropolitan, there's a Judgmental Jane character. We called her Judgmental Jane. and she was very much based on someone who's very judgmental. She's like not speaking to me for some judgmental reason and not speaking to other people for judgmental reason. And the Nick Smith character really did marry a rich woman who's an absolutely great woman. But he married her and could do fantastic writing and architectural research because he didn't have to worry that much about his income.
That is the dream, isn't it? Laura failed in that regard.
I really did.
So we're curious. Here's another sort of related question. So I'm curious, though, how you feel towards your characters, because I think that sometimes the kind of knowing wry depiction of them can feel like it's a kind of satire, like it's a kind of perhaps like light poking fun, but it's also kind of coming, from within. It's clearly written by someone who sort of is part and parcel of these characters, lived in these rooms. And so, so your godfather, we found this on Wikipedia, so excuse the really lame research here, but your godfather popularized the term WASP. And you went to Harvard. And so I would assume that you got to know people who were kind of like these characters, even if they aren't themselves, depicted in the film. And so what I was interested in is what drew you to want to tell the stories of these people in particular?
Well, this idea started when I was shooting and editing Barcelona. Barcelona is an incredibly hard shoot. Mm. So I'm happy that the film turned out, but it was a little bit the sophomore curse as far as the production. So you go to a foreign country and you think that friends who've done one film will be good producers for your film, but they're even kind of less experienced than you are. And I mean, it was conscious that I shifted projects. The first thing I started writing was Barcelona, and I realized, gosh, that's going to be too complicated and too big a deal to do as a first film. I've got to do something really small and manageable on home turf. And so it was such a tough shoot. And one of the only kind of happy, fun days was when we were inside this nightclub and shooting night scenes by day. So one of the problems in the films I've done is they tend to be like the putative alternate title for Last Days of Disco, which is History is Made at Night. Mm-hmm. So they're nighttime socializing films, the first three. And it's really wearisome shooting nights all the time. Mm-hmm. You really burn out because you sort of wake up and do business and work on the day, and then you're fried by the end of the shooting day, and you're busted by the sun coming up. And so all of these complications of shooting at night. There are other nice things, which is it's lovely to be in a busy city at 3 a.m. when it's not busy and you can kind of control it. But in any case, the really happy shooting experience in Barcelona was inside this disco. And we were playing Boogie Oogie Oogie, one of the really fun, warm, non-metallic disco songs. And the crew was really enjoying it because this is a very talky comedy, Barcelona was, and the crew couldn't really enjoy much of it. So they really liked that day for night disco shooting. There are no windows in the disco, so we could, start in the morning and shoot all day and go to sleep at a normal time. And they really enjoyed the Bible dancing scene because they could see that was funny. And so we had this really happy feeling, experience shooting in the disco. And then I really liked all the little disco scenes in Barcelona in the editing room. We really liked them. And we had these lovely actresses, Mira Sorvino and Tishka Bergen and other actresses in them. They were just lovely and just fun to watch. And I think this is really cinematic, pretty girls in a disco. That's cinematic. That's interesting. So that was the idea. Two really pretty girls going to a disco. And it built from there. And then in writing that, you bring in a lot of experience. So I bring in the experience of, you know, struggling in book publishing and all that stuff. They said, and there was one article by an acquaintance, Sloan Crosley. She did this thing for the Times saying that films aren't accurate about book publishing. And she included us as being inaccurate. And the things she said were inaccurate were totally accurate for Doubleday. She was just in at Random House. And we actually, so she said that associate editor was just nothing and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But we would mock or resentfully whine about Random House for title inflation, salary inflation. You know, we were feeling oppressed proles at Doubleday, and they were the conceited special characters at Random House. And so it was just absolutely accurate for Doubleday, but maybe it wasn't accurate for Random House, but I wasn't pretending to be at Random House. Mm-hmm. And so so a lot of, you know, life experience gets in there. And yes, I knew a lot of these sort of Harvard flamboyant characters who could give information to it. And there's something that's a little bit prettified. There's a manic depressive character who becomes becomes kind of the romantic hero. Mm-hmm. Really sympathetically cast by Matt Kieslar, very handsome guy. And that, a lot of those stories from my brother's experience, he flipped out at Harvard and was put in an institution and then recovered and came back and finished. And so that's kind of a prettified version of manic depression there. So these things, you know, get in, but not in the most obvious ways.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I assume then that the sort of guide to getting a hit book published was that lifted straight from Doubleday?
Before you can become an associate editor, you have to have a bestseller.
How can you be sure you'll get a bestseller?
You cannot.
But what if you don't find one?
You have to.
Show them the outline.
You might want to see this. It's the Scott Meredith bestseller outline. Create sympathetic characters with whom readers identify, give them problems, make these problems big.
Can I photocopy this?
Yes, but I need it back.
I'd like a copy too.
Totally. I mean, that was just like exactly my experience of going into that room and that she had that, you know, there's a woman with a European accent, mm-hmm. an Eastern European accent, just like the woman in the movie and pull out the thing. And there's this sort of, you know, that was just all true. And then the ad man character who was put upon to get sort of not very stylish out of town clients into Studio 54. That's a friend who is also one of our metropolitan group. And so that was the Jimmy Steinway experience, was sort of his experience. And he's actually in the film as one of the dancers.
Oh,
he had a SAG card, so he helped us out as a sort of camera extra.
That's funny.
Wow. Was his job ever at stake if he couldn't get the people in?
I mean, I think he felt that way. He felt that they sort of were using him, you know, very hard to get clients in. And he was on the creative side. He was writing ad copy. So mm-hmm. it was odd.
I was thinking about one of the lines and I wanted to just see, first of all, if that was in your mind as well and use that as a jumping off point. So we were thinking about when Charlotte says, have you ever noticed that people who look just alike never seem to know each other? And she says that to Hap when she's sort of trying to help Alice talk to Jimmy. But it struck me as particularly layered given that the guy who purports to be Hap is actually an FBI agent pretending to be an ad client from out of town. And at the same time, we also have characters from Metropolitan and Barcelona in the club, maybe not that night, but it's across several nights. With Taylor Nichols playing both Charlie Black from Metropolitan and Ted Boynton from Barcelona. And then Chris Eichmann, of course, was in both previous movies, but now he's playing Dez. So there's all kinds of like doubling happening in this sort of like otherworldly nightclub. We were just curious if that thought was there when you wrote that line, and also how, if you could just to also talk about how you think of your trilogy as existing within the same universe.
Well, that part, I love what graduate students or people with advanced degrees can do with a simple film. you're giving it a complexity that's not there. The idea of that, the idea of that is it's a wonderful pickup line, I think.
Yeah.
And it's a cynical, overt pickup line. He just says that. She doesn't know anyone who looks like Cap. And then it's more of her just being, you know, this really cool manipulator who's mm-hmm. just going to say anything. And I do remember that line when people, you know, wanted to talk to you and they weren't introduced. And in a party like that, it's sort of more of a dead party line where someone's, oh, you look just like so-and-so. Mm-hmm. And that way they can start talking to you. Mm-hmm. I think I see a lot of the Charlotte character among certain people in Hollywood where, you know, in one period, they're the most one way. So in one period, she's the most, you know, sexual revolution out there, cutting edge, ferociously more advanced than everyone else. And then the moment she can, the moment she needs to, she switches sides and becomes the one, you know, criticizing other people, mm-hmm. Being more moralistic, more Christian, singing hymns. And that happens a lot. There seem to be some people always have to be the most of whatever it is, and they'll change sides mm-hmm. and it'll still be the most. And poor Alice is left being battered from both directions.
I recognized some of that as well.
I think that basically our relationship dynamic is Alice and Charlotte. Wouldn't you say that?
What?
You're the Alice, I'm the Charlotte.
You want to say more on that, Justin?
I tend to be the more extreme. And you know, especially when we're talking about film and stuff, I try to find an extreme interpretation, and Laura's the more measured, you know, moderate. And then I pull Laura to the extremes more, right? Would you say that?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
Well, you can build on the guacamole. Do you know that line from Elaine May in the Woody Allen TV series on Amazon, Crisis in Six Scenes?
I don't know.
Well, there's something you can watch for free on Amazon. I think people considered it to be very bad, but actually it has some really nice things in it. So Amazon did the Woody Allen TV series, A Crisis in Six Scenes, which he hated doing. And I guess you can see he hated doing it because he likes doing films and not series. And there is some miscasting and some misconceptions in it. The second episode is just god awful with a really terrible Patty Hearst character being played by Miley Cyrus in a really irritating way. So you sort of have to skip the second, maybe part of the third episodes.
Noted.
But if you keep on going, there's funny stuff. And Elaine May plays someone doing marriage counseling, couples counseling. And she has two people in and they can't agree on anything. I mean, they're just totally ill-suited to each other, except they get to the point where they both can't stand guacamole. So at the end of the session, she says, well, we'll just have to build on the guacamole. I think it's a good relationship line, you know, when things are at sixes and sevens, say, well, we'll just have to build on the guacamole.
That's great. I love that. Well, on just complex relationships. So we brought up Alice and Charlotte. Your movies focus a lot on the complexities of female friendships. And I was just curious if there was any reason for that. Like if you found female friendships, like what is it that about them that you find so fascinating? One hypothesis is it kind of affords you a kind of reprieve. So you can sort of step back and observe more as an outsider almost. I wasn't sure if that rang true, but I'm just curious, like why female friendships?
Well, I mean, sort of each film you do, it's going to be one thing or another. And I remember we were sort of beaten up during Barcelona because the female characters were much less significant than the male characters. Mm-hmm. And my feeling about that was that, well, this film is about these two cousins and that's a male thing. And other films will be about the female characters and that'll be a female thing. But why criticize, you know, something because you've made a choice to do that?
Yep.
But I do, because this came up first when I was doing mostly the male characters in Metropolitan. And then it occurred to me that the Tom Townsend character, who supposedly is the way into the story and is the protagonist, was just not a very sympathetic or interesting character in certain ways. And so I really wanted to shift it into the Audrey Rouget film.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'd already invested a lot into the Tom character, and I was interested in the Charlie and the Nick characters representing different things I wanted to get off my chest about sociology or mm-hmm. observations. Mm-hmm. And so there were four characters that were pretty significant there. But it's quite important, the Audrey character and Audrey talking to her friends. And what I started thinking is that the romantic predicament of women in our society still, and even more so in, when I was a kid, is kind of more interesting than the male predicament. The male predicament is kind of this tiresome thing. In the old days, you used to be getting up your nerve to make a phone call.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And either get accepted or rejected or somewhere in between. And I've found out since then that that women do not need an entire night to wash their hair. it can be done in like 15 minutes if they want to do it that way. And because there used to be this thing, oh, I can't go out tonight because I've got to wash my hair. and so I sort of, and also I have lived the male experience, so it's sort of not interesting. It's less interesting in certain ways. Mm-hmm. It's like the same old, same old. And then what women do to control their romantic life, to meet the guys they want to meet, to be with the guys they want to meet, seemed to me a more interesting predicament romantically in terms of story than the male situation. But that said, I am going to go back and forth between the two. And like in the case of Lady Susan, it was really part of the territory because, I mean, in the case of Love and Friendship, mm-hmm. because her manuscript, Lady Susan, was almost entirely between women.
Mm.
And we really increased other characters to have more variety because there's a lot of just the Chloe character and the Kate character mm-hmm. just talking to each other and fighting with the Vernon women. So that went with that territory. And I do find writing women characters generally more interesting. But Cosmopolitans and the series that I hope will come in the future is very much male stuff.
I see. Yeah, I mean, I want to offer Laura the chance to speak on this, but like, you know, I I suspect that you're capturing something very something true to life about female friendships. And I mean, when Laura and I first saw Last Days at Disco, and we had long conversations about the Alice and Charlotte sort of dynamic and the complexity of that dynamic, one being this, you know, the Charlotte being the kind of more, you know, she's the like more conventionally attractive, she's had a lot of attention, she's more outgoing, and she sort of parachutes or kind of, you know, drags along Alice to all these clubs as a kind of like wing woman, so to speak. And she all under the pretense of like getting her, you know, helping her. And I think that rang too true to your experience, right, Laura? You've had, you know, you've.
Yeah, no, I have had a Charlotte in my life, yeah. Or two, maybe. And I don't know if this occurs in male friendships, but I can say for sure it happens in female friendships, the sort of unique and unstable situation where a woman is kind of taking another woman under her wing, or at least appearing to, and perhaps also undermining her at the same time.
Right.
There's so many scenes in which Charlotte is like, I think you're so great. It's just a shame everybody hated you in Hampshire, you know. and I've been there, and you sort of feel beholden to that other woman who you feel like is, gosh, she's my real friend because she can say these things and she's showing me the way. And but all of your movies also seem to have people that have a good strong sense of self and an inner compass, and yeah. No matter how much they're surrounded by people that speak very well and wax poetic and, you know, are trying on new ideas, they follow that compass. Audrey being another really good example of that. But yeah, I felt like that that really rung true for me in Last Days. And then, of course, then we sort of see another kind of bringing under the wing with Violet in Damsels in Distress, although it's a much gentler approach than Charlotte's.
Okay. Anything I did that was wrong, I apologize for. But anything I did that was not wrong, I don't apologize for. God, Alice is such a Scorpio.
Although I think a lot of people have problems with the Violet character before the story develops. So there's the first 30 minutes of Damsels in Distress. You just see this sort of opposite of cliche character. I mean, I think everyone thinks she's the mean girl and she's the bad girl. Mm-hmm. And Lily will turn into the sweet identification character. And it's sort of not doing that exactly.
No.
It's doing something else in the first half hour. And I think people really, really hate it because they can't quite go along with it. And then finally, tables are turned. And Violet becomes a protagonist in a different way, and maybe the film might win people over. But a lot of people just tune out of Damsels within the first 20 minutes, and then write nasty things about it too. And there's one very influential journalist at the Times of London who savaged the film. Mm. Said she walked out after 18 minutes, and I analyzed that. Like, that means like around 8 minutes in, they're deciding to go. And then 12 minutes, they really have their nerve to bother everyone on their row. You know, 6 minutes to sort of creep out of the cinema, you know, and how much, you know, just amazing. Like someone with like 200,000 Twitter followers on the first Saturday of the tiny Sony release. Both Damsels and Disco got a lot of negative static. Damsels particularly. Disco, we're really lucky with the prestige critics. So really lucky with Jay Carr in Boston, Janet Maslin, and Kenneth Turan. We got a kind of brickbat from a very good critic at Variety that was sort of surprising because he had loved Barcelona. But generally the prestige critics were pretty great, but then everything else was negative. Like every magazine writer, every smaller publication whined about it. And so one of the big criticisms was, why does Alice stick with Charlotte?
Why does
she put up with that? You know? And so there are all kinds of, and one woman, I mean, we were sort of plugged into the big cinema world, which actually isn't a very kind world. So a lot of people coming to the junket. So we couldn't really afford an actual press junket, but I think there's another big film in town. So Castle Rock P backed on the junket people from the other junket, and we had a semi-junket. And that's not good. Generally, those people are really burnout and cynical. And so one person said, oh, I went to Discos, and I worked in publishing that period, and neither this disco nor publishing was like that. And I mean, and there are a lot of things about the nightclub in it, the film, that's a stretch. You know, the people have conversations and stuff like that. It's not deafeningly loud. But the publishing house is exactly the way Doubleday was. And this way of criticizing things, of not being realistic, I think it's a really weak way of criticizing things, because are you sure your experience is absolutely universal? And a lot of the people who attacked it for being unrealistic, because they say, oh, Disco's really black and working class people. And not really. There were black people, there were working class people, there were gay people. But Studio 54, they love preppies, they love the debutante crowd. They were kind of the social climbing thing, where if you were going to some charity function and had to put on black tie, let's go to Studio 54 afterwards, because maybe dressed like this we'll be able to get in. And so I just think this idea of sort of realism can kind of trap people a lot, and just sort of expose their parochialism. And so I think with the passage of, oh, the people saying it wasn't accurate, I'd ask them, well, what disco are you thinking of that it doesn't, you know, what is the school you went to that was so different? And they say, oh, I hated disco, I never went to one. I like punk. But they had this journalistic idea of what a disco was, based on, I guess, Saturday Night Fever and something else. And the guy who wrote, you know, the Saturday Night Fever article, as we now know, never went inside the he was wasted. He looked he saw the door, and he saw someone coming out of the door, and that was the extent of his research for his article, wow, Saturday Night Fever. The rest was made up.
Wow.
I mean, but what I think is so interesting about this is that there are two points that I want to make, just to building on what you said, which I think are just worth saying right now, since we have you, the director, here, and I don't know. But the first is that, like, this whole idea of criticizing a film on the basis of realism is sort of odd to me on the grounds that when I watch one of your films, I feel like there's a compact made with the viewer almost immediately, which is that, like, this film is going to exist in its own world. Mm-hmm. It's not quite the world you might have known. It's a sort of slightly different world. And that's part of what's so fun about your films, is that you get to kind of, like, we watched them all in close order, and it was really felt like we were just, like, in a little world, in a little separate universe that, where, like, the laws don't apply, so to speak, and things are slightly different, and everything's heightened, and it's fun, and it's lively and jovial. And that's why we want to go to the movies. We don't necessarily want to go just to have
to see our lives.
Yeah, to see our lives, or just have something depicted purely realistically. So that was the first thing, is it's, like, weird when, especially the movie almost announces itself as not attempting any kind of, you know, pure realism, but rather trying to do, kind of capture something that Werner Herzog calls the ecstatic truth of the moment.
Well, it's Damsels that's really not trying to be realistic. Mm-hmm. I think the other ones are, so the others are sort of in the naturalistic world with a sort of romantic, rose-colored cast to it. Where Damsels, we want to do something stylized under it and not more fun than realism.
Yeah. I mean, but the other thing is that I think that your films have what I don't know what people call them, like, legs or something, which is, like, that they're the kinds of things which there's an element, we'll get into this in a bit, but there's an element of universality to them, I think, which helps to forge their staying power. As, I mean, this is twofold, partly because there's all this specific stuff going on, but at the same time, you're sort of dealing with these really universal themes in a way that's very, I don't know, it's very sophisticated, it's very sort of timeless in a way. And I think that enables them to be rediscovered by newer generations. And then when those newer generations who have, like us, we have no connection to the disco scene. So we don't know, we know absolutely nothing about how that was, what the world was like. So it's very easy for us to just kind of get lost in the movie as it is, as it's presented to us, and not worry about those kinds of details. And I suspect that is, you know, I think that your movies are going to continue to be rediscovered in that way. I think it's also interesting, just on that point, that, you know, the generation that's being depicted in the movies are basically late baby boomers. The generation that's depicting them are Gen Xers. And then, you know, our generation here, we're having this conversation, we're millennials, right? And it's just that, you know, it kind of persists and it goes on. And I think that element of timelessness is really one of the selling points, I think, of your films.
Oh, thanks. I think there are two factors related to that. One is, when the film came out in 98, there are other things happening that made people think that disco is coming back. So there's a competing film about Studio 54 called 54, although everyone called the nightclub Studio. And I mean, Castle Rock was panicked by that and really hated the idea of another film and worried about it and pressured us to go first. And some of the people who were involved with us were involved with that. And Castle Rock was really angry that one of our putative producers was also a putative producer on that and made him drop out of our film. But then this journalistic thing happened. Disco hadn't been that much earlier, really. The film was quite close to the period it's depicting. And there was, like, this idea that we were trying to foist disco back on people who didn't want it. And a lot of sort of putting our film in with this thing and that thing and another thing and all together. And, you know, just was really negative. I mean, I think a lot of people think that's favorable. Oh, it's a wave. No, it wasn't favorable at all. It was really negative. And the other thing is that the film is sort of strange in form. And I think partly it's strange in form because of the rush. So, okay, none of my films are rushed. I take at least 4 years between films, not rushed. But comparatively to the other ones, this seemed like there was pressure to finish the script as soon as possible and then to edit it and get it out as soon as possible. Although Kasturk was incredibly generous with letting us shoot longer than we had expected, which was tough, really tough on the cast. And so the film, I think because of this, I think it has a kind of ungainly shape. It's kind of a mess. And if people see the DVD the Criterion put out, there are a lot of cut scenes. There's sort of a whole... Did you see those?
We didn't see those, actually. Yeah, we
there's would. A whole yeah. There's a whole sort of subplot. There's all the stuff, you know, Dez watching Wild Kingdom in his apartment, and Jimmy Steinway comes by, and a little romance scene between the Chloe character and the Chris Eigenman character, and, you know, little things like that. And also we've been impressed by the running time, and I did something stupid, which was cutting little frames from the beginning and the ending of each scene to sort of make it go faster. And actually, you end up making the film seem longer. And so the film is kind of a mess. I mean, it's kind of ungainly. And I think when people first watch something, when they first come out, they go with this kind of critical, judgmental thing, like checking the boxes. Does this have narrative momentum? Mm-hmm. Does this have a, you know, coherent plot? And all these things, is this realistic? All these kind of obnoxious defenses against getting into something. And some people did get into it. I mean, I think if you go, it's Saturday night, I'm going with some friends, just want to see it and like it, and we don't want to be too judgmental, then they can like it. So it had a lot of supporters, but also had a lot of negative stuff happening. And then over time, I think that ungainliness, that weirdness, that sort of not very normalness of a lot of the structure makes it possible to rewatch it sooner than some other films. Like some other films, I think you really like them, but maybe you don't want to watch them that many times.
Yeah.
Well, I think this film and its ungainliness and all the stuff that's going on in it might bear rewatching. More than other films.
I think that's totally right. I was going to have one other thing, which is that the film, I think one of the reasons it also just continues to build in a weird way, like get momentum and get other viewers to come in, is that it's your films in general, not just Disco, but have had an influence on film, you know, on popular film. And through Noah Baumbach, through Wes Anderson, Lena Dunham, and so on. And so, these filmmakers who took a lot of the sort of style almost and the subject matter you're working with and suffused it into movies that ended up being seen by a lot of people. Then when these people end up, you know, coming back to see some of your films, that I think they can see it through that lens. So for instance, like there was a sequence in Barcelona where there's some, I can't remember exactly, I mean, we've only seen it once, but there's a voiceover kind of montage. And I was just like, holy man, that is like straight up Wes Anderson.
Even the disasters that strike those we are closest to only reach us filtered through our own colossal egotism. My response to what happened to Fred was swamped in subjective emotion, mostly guilt. I prayed for him all the time, but with the constant doubt that I was probably just kidding myself. I was beginning to suspect my religious faith was largely bogus. I resolved to stay there all the time and do whatever I possibly could to improve Fred's chances for recovery.
You know, and just being able to see it through that, I thought, oh, it clicks. It makes it so easy to watch. And what you were talking about like ungainliness, I think can now be seen as like something. Yeah, it's just become part of like film language almost.
I guess if you're trying to get a lot of content into a film, a lot of sort of story content and ideas and sort of observations, it's going to keep it from being a sort of purely admirable piece of film art or whatever that is. It's going to keep it out of the big festivals. Mm. And but then maybe it becomes more like a book where, you know, you can kind of curl up with it later and at leisure devour it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, It's funny that you feel like it's ungainly. I love how much some stuff happens off screen, some stuff happens on screen. The movie just feels exactly the way life flows, especially in that period of time after college and you're sort of moving in different orbits and circles and people kind of flow in and out of your life. It felt incredibly natural to me. But I was also thinking, you know, some of the best movies are Shaggy. I was thinking about Magnolia, which I was one of those movies that kind of blew my mind as a teenager. And that movie is messy and shaggy and also amazing.
There's a Shaggy movie that I really like and not many people have seen. It was a Merchant Ivory film, and it's based on James Jones's daughter's novel, sort of based on their experience in Paris. It's called A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries. Have you guys seen it?
Mm-mm.
It sort of somehow fell between the cracks. I think it's one of those things where the financier or the distributor failed and it was left orphaned. And I took it really to heart because I just moved over to Paris and was living in Île-Saint-Louis with my daughters. And, you know, struggling to write. And then there, here's a story about an American writer, Île-Saint-Louis in Paris, struggling to write with his family. And so many little things in it we were experiencing. But that movie, in the middle of it, I thought, where is this film going? What is it about? What is happening? Because they shift from being in Paris to being somewhere in New England. And you say, gosh, what kind of storytelling is this? And then the second part of the story clicks in and it becomes this delightful, wonderful, weepy, and really moving. And I liked that movie so much more because in the middle of it, I was totally lost. I had no idea what was happening. And I think it's too much, you know, with the all these screenplay courses and formulas, and you sort of know, I mean, there's so many scripts that were being done they're no longer being done in Hollywood, but there's a period sort of in the 90s when all these scripts you'd get, you could tell the whole film from the first page.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's great when we get out of that. And so one reason why I really like, so I love cinema from the 30s, and I think 36 to 41, you get sort of studio perfection. But 30 to 35, what you get is, we don't know the formulas yet.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't care about the stuff that people like of pre-code movies that they're racier or there's nudity or I don't know what the things people, I don't like that at all. But what I like is there are no formulas. They don't know they have to conform to some formula.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this film that I think you can find on YouTube called Double Harness. And the characters who'd be the heroes in a modern film or any film, you know, in the last 50 years are sort of morally compromised. And the haute bourgeois characters are kind of solid and admirable. And it's like really strange to watch because, I mean, they're all sort of sympathetic in their predicament, but it doesn't do the thing we sort of have to do now where you have to pretend that, you know, the outsider is the good person and the insiders are the bad people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people who are comfortably off materially are the bad people and the people who have less are the good people. And, you know, why is that? It's not true. And it's great to see the films with that formula from back then.
That's really, that is really interesting. And I can definitely see the influence on your work and your writing as well. I mean, I think that's another thing that makes it interesting in today's day is to watch these movies and have it exactly like that. As you said, like the comfortable character is the good guy. Like they're all complicated, but they're not deemed bad simply because they have money or because they have a certain amount of privilege.
Well, I think a lot of a problem in entertainment is catering to the lowest common denominator or the common denominator.
Yeah.
I don't want to be pejorative about the common denominator, but it's they want to kind of win friends really quickly, really easily. And it's like they take a niche and then just exploit it to death. and they only do the niches they know will be popular. And so in a way, they're constantly reducing the cinema audience by only focusing on the surefire genres and not doing anything in between that might appeal to people who don't want to see Marvel or whatever the other things are. Mm-hmm.
So you did mention that the seed of this of disco was Two Beautiful Women go to a disco. So you do cast very beautiful people who engage in romantic trysts, and yet your characters often are skeptical of the role that physical attraction plays in romantic relationships across films. So, for example, in Damsel's Distress, Violet talks about dating unintelligent men or unattractive men as a kind of social work, noting that it can be both rewarding and reassuring. And then Alice in Disco says that she's beginning to think that maybe the old system of people getting married based on mutual respect and shared aspirations, and then slowly over time earning each other's love and admiration worked best. I think that comes in a moment where she's particularly low and bummed out about her romantic prospects. And we really often, in this movie in particular, encounter sex via its mostly negative consequences. Poor Alice, you know, and her STIs, and then Charlotte's possible pregnancy. And this leads one to maybe think that many of your characters, and perhaps yourself, would prefer to engage in group socializing over all that ferocious pairing off. So does that ring true to you?
Well, I like the ferocious pairing off, but the less ferocious pairing off. But I think before you get there, you have to have group social life. Mm-hmm. And I think group social life is really important. And I think more attention should be paid to it. I don't think they do it anymore. But when I was at university in Cambridge, they had the Cambridge Boathouse dances. Mm-hmm. They were sort of a... Do they still have those?
I don't think so. I mean, I haven't heard of it.
So some sort of social butterflies got together and arranged this thing. So sort of all the sort of people who'd be interested in that kind of thing were invited to these dances that were like sort of huge mixers at the Cambridge Boathouse. And I mean, that was great. It just seemed like a really cool thing. And I just don't think things like that, it seems like it happens much anymore. I guess there are other things people do. So I do like that ensemble. I mean, the real character who goes deeply into that is the Ted Boynton character.
Right, in Barcelona.
In Barcelona. Mm-hmm. That's where it's really front and center. But I do think that people who other people would consider good looking often learn not to care that much about looks. So sometimes they're really homely people who seem to care a lot about looks, who have, despite their homeliness, have one very good looking, you know, friend after another. And while there's some very good looking person who doesn't care about it and just is with anyone. Hmm. And so, I mean, I do think that looks are the first, I mean, if you're, I mean, I think one of the intentions of the movies is not to give people bad advice about romance. So, and I think maybe Metropolitan's strength is I thought I knew what the score was when I made Metropolitan. And over time, I think I'm less and less confident I know what works best, less and less sure of anything. So in a way I'm handicapped from, you know, making film decisions in the right way for romantic comedies. And so the first thing that you learn is looks aren't important. You know, really should get beyond looks. And I think the second thing to learn, and it's a tough thing to learn, is charm can be really deceptive too. Mm. So someone can be really charming and really appealing and seem like a good person, but that's not to be taken at face value.
It's really important there be more group social life, not just all this ferocious pairing off. You like Tom. Invite him.
You don't even have an apartment. How can we have a dinner party?
Well, it's another incentive to get one.
So George Plimpton appears in a cameo in the club. So I was just curious, like, did you guys know each other, or how did he come to be in your film?
Well, that's a sort of cautionary tale or a life, you know, experience of interest to me, at least. So you mentioned Digby Baltzol. You know, a lot of people get reduced to to sort of one thing. People, it's shorthand. So I think I was marked by the fact that Metropolitan was the first film. So everything is seen in terms of sort of social content, when maybe they could be seen, the films could be seen in a different way. Digby Boltzel, I think he coined, I mean, this is under dispute, but he was doing his PhD thesis at Columbia, and he did a chart where he put WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, in part of a chart. And I think his tutor, the person guiding his thesis, used it in an article. And a lot of people think that he had a bestseller in the 60s called The Protestant Establishment. And a lot of people think, oh, this term comes out of the Protestant Establishment. And then they find that some sociologists used it before the Protestant Establishment. Mm-hmm. This is where the fact-checking whole problem gets in. People jump to a conclusion fact-checking, and they actually are wrong. So everyone says, oh, he didn't do it, someone else. No, I think he really did it back in the 40s as part of this chart that was then used by other people and then used by himself. But it wasn't his bestseller from the 60s. It was before that. And he wrote some great books later on. He wrote a really interesting intellectual book that took him forever to write. He was so discouraged. You know, it was a 10 or 12 year process, and I don't know what that's like. But he was just working on this one thing while I had all these failed projects that didn't happen. So, and it was called Puritan Boston and Quaker Philadelphia. And it's a really, really great intellectual history that I really recommend to people. And then he did a book after that called, I think it's called Sporting Gentlemen. And it's about how tennis was ruined by professionalism. And he loved the amateur spirit. And he starts the book out with an anecdote of going to some person being led around a prison in Britain, and one of the prisoners who's you know, giving him the guided tour says, "Well, that's just not cricket, isn't it? Just not cricket. It's just not right." And so he likes the idea of sort of the amateur spirit when right and wrong. He hated John McEnroe being like the bad boy. He just detested John McEnroe, and he loved Arthur Ashe as a gentleman, and you know, loves all these people. I think a lot of them he knew. And so it was an attack on the professionalism of tennis. And so being a contrarian, everyone seemed to love George Plimpton. Everyone talked about George Plimpton. George Plimpton is so great. And so I would sort of think not much of George Plimpton, you know, blah. And I went to a screening where George Plimpton was there, and he had just done a brutally negative review of Digby Boltzel's book in the Wall Street Journal, where it really should have gotten a good review. And because it's kind of up their alley in certain ways, and they signed it to George Plimpton, and he really panned it because he's exactly part of the commercialized world that Boltzel was attacking. And they come from sort of the same world, but completely different. You know, it's like civil war within a class, completely different groups within that. So I came up to him like with practically without being introduced. I just think I sort of started attacking him about the review. and he sort of stepped back very sort of kindly and said, who's Boltzel? Is he your uncle or your father, your cousin? So he knew.
He figured it out.
And so he was so nice. And then we had mutual friends who wanted to put us together on a project. And I really got to know him. And he was an absolutely great guy. I mean, just so great. I only got to know him sort of his last decade, but we had a project together to do based on his sort of romantic experiences in Europe, in Venice and Paris and Lake Como. And it's really, you know, it was interesting romantic. Then I found out all kinds of secrets of George Plimpton's life that no one knew. He thought he'd give it to me as part of the research process. And I mean, his romance was with one of the women who was a real life model for Holly Golightly.
Wow.
So Truman Capote rented the apartment, the basement apartment in her house she had with a photographer, romantic partner in Brooklyn. So it's a woman named B. Dabney, and he thought it was Holly Golightly, which isn't bad. So I really got to love George Plimpton, and he agreed to be in the film along with Anthony Hayden Guest, another habitué, sort of social habitué. And so that is sort of an experience where you do that contrarian thing of sort of not liking someone because everyone else likes them, and you sell them short when they're really great people, and you should appreciate them while they're alive because they're going to die.
Now, on that note, I did want to ask you what's on the horizon. Like,
I think you mentioned a series.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I hope a series will emerge. So it's not The Cosmopolitans, but there are some elements of The Cosmopolitans I'd like to put in, and I think certain parts of the DNA will exist in other projects.
That sounds great. Well, on that note, thank you, Whit, for joining us today on Cows in the Field to talk about Last Days of Disco, which is a movie we absolutely adore. We love all your movies. For me, Last Days of Disco is my favorite. I think for Laura, it's Damsels. But
Well, thanks a lot for doing that. But one thing about the title of your podcast, it's a cool title, but shouldn't it be Not Cows?
I know.
Somebody says, we're not cows.
We don't want to be cows. It's one of those anti-aspirational things. We want to be reminded of what we don't want to be.
Well, where I am right now, there are a lot of cows here, so you definitely don't want to be like them.
That's right.
I can say. Okay.
Exactly.
Well, it was great talking to you. Thanks very much for doing this.
Thanks,
Whit.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.